This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman. This is London FinTech Podcast, episode 16. The new year is a time of reflection, time for looking forwards, and a time to take stock. So in this light, this will be a special, somewhat off-piste episode with just me at the microphone. So if you're tuning in to hear a fintech talk about fintech, then tune out now. Or rather, wait a week or so when I have several fantastic shows and guests lined up for you. If you haven't tuned out, then this show has three parts. In part one, as with all the shows, I try and have a little human element. Talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stories that go into making up the London FinTech Podcast, and share some of my thoughts about the challenges of the creative journey, a journey which many fintechs will have been through and are going through. In part two, I discuss the principal trends that I expect to see in UK fintech in 2015. In part three, I discuss the societal aspect of fintech and its media narratives. Will alternative finance end up becoming self-centred and greedy like the existing disliked banking system? Can it retain some alt vibe as it matures? Can fintech have a social conscience? Is fintech just about creating some new mega corporates that will live in tall, shiny buildings? Can fintech be about more than the personal self-enrichment narrative? So, as there is no one to interrupt me on the show today, oh no, that's a Freudian slip, note to self, whatever you do, Mike, make sure you edit that bit out. Don't, for God's sake, leave it in the final show. Cough, right, okay, let's do that bit again. So, as a just little on me today, let's get on with the show without further ado. So let's start with a behind-the-scenes peek at the London FinTech Podcast, which went from an idea to 15 episodes and nigh on 5,000 downloads in 60 countries worldwide in less than 5 months. In a world where, allegedly, all of our attention spans can only cope with tweets, it's reassuring and rewarding that folks are prepared to take half an hour to stick with one topic. The saying that no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public may explain a lot about cable TV, and for that matter, terrestrial TV in the UK. Lord Reith, whose founding mission was that the BBC should educate and entertain, has been spinning in his grave for a long time. However, alt, or indie media, in this digital age, is a great vehicle for not racing to assume that the average public IQ is 10. And actually, at its best, it does live up to Reith's educate and entertain maxim more than Reith's institution does. The indie market shows that there is demand for thoughtful material. And not just thoughtful material, which could be rather worthy but dull, perhaps, but what I think of as human material. The mainstream media has become so abstracted from how people act and talk in real life. I don't know whether it's just me, but over my lifetime, US newscasters have become more and more android-looking in appearance. News bots towing the corporate line. Anyway, back to the London FinTech Podcast. I'm not just aiming here at going behind the curtain. I think at this point you can imagine the Wizard of Oz with little wizened old me pulling levers and trying to create a much more impressive image out front. Rather, a lot of what I've been through has many elements in common with starting all new ventures, whether tech, fintech, podcast, or anything else. As I've related before, I set up what would now be called a fintech in 1998. So I've lived and breathed the vibe for many years, albeit in an environment in which the concept didn't exist, so there was hardly a prevailing wind. Take away from that one, by the way, timing is everything. However, in terms of the word fintech, I don't think I came across that before mid-2013. And that was after doing a biz dev gig in the first half of the year for a fintech that didn't even know it was a fintech, which shows you how new it all is. With my background, someone said to me that I ought to get into the fintech scene, but I looked around and apart from a few notable companies, didn't see much. Partly because, as with my 2013 chums, plenty of folks hadn't leapt on the brand yourselves as a fintech wagon. However, in 2014, due, I feel, to a lot of government and mayoral impetus, in particular the highly successful and pivotal inaugural London Tech Week, it was hard to avoid. What was the original creative pulse behind this podcast? When did an idea appear out of nothing? I recall awaking in the middle of the night and thinking, hey, I don't think there's a podcast on fintech. Now, I must say, that's not the most exciting thing to have on one's mind in the middle of the night. I'm sure I've had far more entertaining thoughts. However, and the ancient Greeks perhaps had the origins of creativity sussed more than we do, the creative muse that comes to call every now and then never wears a watch. A sequence of other synchronicities followed. Rare that this happens, but perhaps a sign that one is on the right track. I thought I should get on Twitter, which I'd never really done before. Now, of course, using the handle hashtag London FinTech Podcast would take up roughly half a tweet in itself, so I needed something shorter. To my surprise, hashtag London FinTech wasn't taken. Just shows how new this whole FinTech thing is. My first conversation was with Warren Bond, and we recorded the show in a business club I'm a member of in one of Berkeley Square's finest buildings. It transpired that Warren's first meeting in London some 20+ years ago was in the very same building. In the next episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. James Smith about Bitcoin. Turns out he was at Cambridge about 20 years after me, at a different college, but amazingly enough had exactly the same supervisor as I. Coincidences / synchronicities followed for many episodes, so much so that I've forgotten most of them by now. But a nice one was that completely by chance, r5fx.com, who in passing realised later in the year a significant investment in them by Deutsche Börse, happened to be episode 5. Another useful coincidence / synchronicity was bumping into a chap at Google Campus who's a professional filmmaker who gave me some helpful advice, not least of which, how to avoid saying If there was a following wind to the propitious venture, there were certainly crosswinds. I assembled all the mobile recording kit for the first conversation, and there was a terrible buzz. Oh no. I turned it all off, unplugged it all, plugged it back in, and it went away. Phew. Until the guest entered the room. At which point, it came back. Ah! Can you imagine? Fortunately, it went away when we started recording. The following show was recorded at Google Campus. I got there very early in order to have one of the great coffees they serve, especially as I was feeling sleepy that day. Drank coffee, noticed nothing. So I had another one. Very tasty, but still noticed nothing. Oh well, I'll have a small third one. Right, better go to the fourth floor. And by the way, the cafe's in the basement if you haven't been there, so that's 5 floors. Got to lift. Broken. Ah! So, running up the staircase, by about floor 3, oxygen debt and all the caffeine suddenly kicked in at the same time. If that episode is more hyper than the average, that's why. Lots of crazy things continued. On the way in to record one episode, a guy collapsed dead on the train. Not just that, but he was actually sitting next to me and collapsed dead on top of me. Chaos ensued and he literally expired at my feet as some poor railway police attempted to revive him with mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, with no result. At the jollier end, a certain guest who should remain nameless cracked me up just as I was about to read the intro, which I will script to get the show running. It took me several goes to start that one. So if the podcast sometimes looks like a swan serenely gliding along on the surface, well, there's all sorts of things going on below the waterline. One of the better business books last year was From Zero to One by Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. This argues, roughly speaking, that competition is for losers. You want to be the one, capital T, capital O. A nice point for rarity. However, maybe I can talk about, at least as we stand today, what it's like to get to a position where one is the one. How did I get there? There were plenty of challenges and oh shits along the way. One of them was right at the beginning in Tech Week, telling someone about my plans, only for them to say, look, I have to tell you something. I and my husband, who worked at the BBC for many years, are already doing our podcast. Gulp. Oh shit. Works for the BBC. Knows how this whole recording business thing works. I met a few others along the way who were going to start a podcast, including someone who'd already recorded several episodes. In the end, as far as I know, all fell by the wayside, principally as, although it might sound easy, doing a podcast is not. A lot of hard work goes into the shows. There's a very long workflow. I basically worked full-time and sometimes more last year to get 15 episodes out. The editing alone takes over a day. Mind you, that's my fault, or rather my perfectionism's fault. I rather like the maxim that if in podcasting content is king, then audio quality is queen. I heard a successful podcaster say that editing a 30-minute show should take 30 minutes. Well, if you leave it raw, it might, but not if you painstakingly remove all, or most, of the ums and ahs and coughs and word repetitions. When you listen back to recording, one can literally hear that many people will often say the same word up to perhaps 6 times, and not even stutterers. So there's a large barrier to entry to this field. However, in a way, this pain is actually a good thing. This natural barrier to entry helps keep competition away. So in terms of you thinking of doing something, if it's easy for you, it'll be easy for the next person. If it's hard work, well, that eliminates most potential competitors already. The other key sharing point is bootstrapping. How to do the Indian rope trick. How to go from zero to one. There's something fascinating about that part of the creative process. The blank canvas. The holding the guitar before you know which note comes first. The hardest part of my bootstrap was not getting listeners. Maybe I should have worried more about that, but I was so concerned with the content that I was happy to follow Lemmy of Motorhead's comment about playing your own song and eventually your audience will find you. A nice change from the usual sell, sell, sell vibe. No, the problem was more getting the interviewees. Why? Well, let's pretend you're a fintech superstar and by some chance I'm talking to you. And that in itself, of course, is a non-trivial business process. Thank the Lord for the likes of Eddie's new finance meetups and also, although perhaps more on the audience side, Silicon Drinkabout. How would the conversation have gone? Something like this. Hi, I'm Mike.
Hi, I'm Bob Superstar. What do you do, Mike?
I host the London FinTech Podcast. Hey, cool. How many listeners do you have? None. Oh, okay. How many episodes? None. Do you know what you're doing? No, but I'm sure I'll work it out. Not the greatest sales line, perhaps, although radical honesty is sometimes refreshing. I put my first 30,000 feet overview show out there and vividly recall a coffee in Canary Wharf with a buddy in August a couple of weeks later who asked me how many shows I'd lined up. Answer, none. Buddy kindly points out that I will lose all credibility very soon and look a complete prat if nothing happens for weeks. Indeed. Gulp. And again, I think there's a lesson here. If you're not prepared to go out there, put your ass on the line, and risk having egg on your face, then you ain't taking enough risk to do anything original. Now, once again, this is a flip side, in that it is another barrier to entry. Most people aren't crazy enough to take such a risk, or the risks that the likes of Zopa took when they created peer-to-peer lending out of nothing, or Nakamoto when he created Bitcoin, again, out of nothing, or perhaps in Nakamoto's case, by extension of previous ideas. What keeps one going in these circumstances? Well, I guess faith. There's a great line from the very gothic album Faith by The Cure, before they became overly poppy. Line being, there's nothing left but faith. I guess that's a well-known concept in Western theology, the idea of faith without evidence. But that wouldn't be quite right, as I'm sure other founders of anything have also experienced. Let's take a more Eastern perspective on faith. Faith in Sanskrit is shraddha, which is better translated as trustful confidence, or perhaps conviction. I have shraddha that I can ride a bike. I guess I had shraddha that even if I had zero listeners, zero guests, zero shows, and zero experience, that somehow I would muddle through. I say this not to praise myself. I know artists and musicians for whom the blank sheet of canvas or music is a daily occurrence. I say it rather to encourage others. And again, it's not just me on the Simple Podcast. All the other fintechs, particularly the radical ones, who started, had to get to this period where there was no evidence it was going to work out, and it was just shraddha, it was just faith that got them carrying on. Another important point about creativity is Koestler's point from his huge tome, The Act of Creation. His angle is that creativity involves putting together pre-existing pieces in a different way. After all, a song, some art, and a podcast are all very recognisable things. It's just the song about this done that way, the picture of that done another way, or in this case, a podcast on FinTech in London. My final experience around creating and advice that I'd share, or particularly creating something fresh, would be don't listen to advice. If one is well inside everyone's comfort zone and experience, then asking buddies for advice may well generally be helpful. However, when pushing the frontiers, it's less than useless. It's harmful. Almost all the advice I was given would have taken me back to the centre where creativity is largely absent. Few folks have been out on the edge, extending the boundaries, creating a new venture from scratch. Most folks will give, quotes, rational advice. But it's not rational to do something crazy in the first place. Without being crazy, you won't take the risks. To give you a simple example, plenty of people gave me the seemingly rational advice to get quite a few episodes in the bag before I started. But if I'd done that, it would have seriously risked someone else getting there first. Furthermore, it's based on ignorance of the actual process. The actual process is more like finding one snowflake and sticking it to the next snowflake, at which point you've got a micro snowball, at which point you can start to roll it. And in my case, fortune favoured the insane, as one day I received, out of the blue, an email from Caroline Bolton in South Africa, who'd heard my first show, where I gave a 30,000 feet overview myself, and she was inquiring whether I'd be interested in talking to Warren on the podcast. At which point I had my two snowflakes, and this micro snowball I could start gently rolling. Not only that, but Warren was a great guest. Going full circle, the first conversation episode started with a great social good project that Warren is doing in terms of sport for all in the township. Anyway, before we get on to Occupy FinTech, let's get to part two of the show, and let's get to the core of FinTech in the UK in 2015. In part two, I'll talk about the five themes I think we'll see in 2015. These five are respectively less spin, a shakeout, FinTech maturing and breaking up into subsectors, groupthink in the subsectors, and NewFS getting more solid. These all go under the overarching theme of 2015, the year when FinTech grows up. Number one, less spin please, we're British. 2014 was perhaps the most interesting year for the city since Big Bang in the 80s in terms of the landscape changing. Less so at the institutional level, plenty of existing institutions still having their head in the sand and exposing their thinking parts. More so, and perhaps the most creative year for the market I've seen in my whole career, in terms of the flood of folks getting out there and having a go at creating. The act of creation is praiseworthy and noble, especially when, as with any startup, the odds are stacked against you. There's an interesting book called American Shaolin. The eponymous hero slash anti-hero learns what courage is, goes into a fight, knowing he will lose. I think the most common remark made to me was that folks are surprised about what a positive part the UK and London governments have played in the scene. Of course, like anything else, this ends up going too far. I commented in my very first episode that the mantra, I still wince when I hear it repeated, that London is the tech capital of the world, is based on so-called research, aka PR slash lies slash spin, that includes Oxford and Cambridge in the definition of London, and Boots the Chemist in the definition of tech. What the? Still, making a noise and creating a buzz has been helpful, even if the excesses thereof are somewhat shame-worthy. One of the things that people with no city slash financial services experience don't realise is that in this market, people love speaking to each other. From the early origins of all city activities in coffee houses, through to the coffee houses and bars today, city folks love getting together and talking about how things really are. Even compared to my experience, I've been amazed at how much uniformity of opinion there's been in these conversations about the entities and individuals who are massively overspinning. So my takeaway from this is that in financial services in the UK, you can impress outsiders with spin for sure. However, that exacts a heavy price in terms of losing your credibility with the insiders. And in financial services, credibility and trust is very, very, very important. FinTech is not tech. You may not have folks' lives at stake, but you do have their money at stake. Trust and credibility are paramount. Theme 2, a shakeout from the gold rush is coming. Let's look at the gold rush nature of FinTech in 2014. As we all proverbially know, a gold rush attracts lots of folks who don't know anything about mining and plenty of tourists. Apart from those who find the gold in the first place, in our case the likes of Zopa, TransferWise et al., the solid cohort who started long before the days of spin, the major sector to benefit from the actual gold rush are those who sell sandwiches and shovels to those who follow. In this regard, it's a real cornucopia for those selling shovels and sandwiches, or rather PR, advertising, social media, incubator space, industry bodies, etc., etc. Plenty of companies have parted with good money, most of which, at best, is a better deal for the seller rather than the buyer. In the current issue of the very professionally produced and free Tech City News printed edition, there's an article to this point about advertising, which ends, using their capital for customer acquisition may help temporarily, but in the end is only going to help the advertising agencies. In the old days, it was said that a company which had raised too much funds would commission a bust of the chairman and get a fountain in reception. I will leave it as an exercise for the listener as to who and what will be shaken out. My aim here isn't to diss individuals or organisations, or those simply brave enough to run into a battle they're unlikely to win. However, theme number 2 remains something of a shakeout. Mixing metaphors, if Mount Vesuvius erupted in 2014, a lot of dust will settle in 2015, and the winners and losers, both personal and institutional, will start to become clearer. Theme 3. FinTech maturing and breaking up into speciated areas. We can already see that the industry bodies who are gaining traction and a reputation for adding value are the likes of the Digital Currency Association and the UK Peer-to-Peer Finance Association. Focused domain-specific areas which are self-contained and have specific issues. So if your bookmaker gives you good odds, I'd short anything with the word FinTech in it, as that umbrella label will become less relevant and the sectors, the subsectors, will become more important. Hang on a minute, this podcast has got the word FinTech in the title. Shit. Mike, note to self, edit that bit out as well, mate. Don't want folks shorting the London FinTech podcast. It will be embarrassing to have a share price less than zero. Right, okay, restart from now. There are some common issues across, say, digital currencies, peer-to-peer, and new tech firms selling it to banks. Maybe, but I don't think there are many. If we look at the interesting changes in the financial background, peer-to-peer is far ahead. ISAs, SIPs, offsetting personal capital gains against income. These are very subsector-specific issues, where the devil is in the detail. Typical FS, by the way, which is why spin is for the birds. It's at the subsector, or even the individual company level, that long, patient consultation by individual firms, or even individuals with a treasury, has led to these changes. If subsectorisation is a result of the industry maturing, then what is going to happen at the company level? There are numerous ways of slicing and dicing, but in terms of the growth curve over time, one model that I favour is startup, scale up, and mature. 2014 was definitely the year of the startup. All those accelerators, incubators, media hype, and a flood of folks launching their own fintech. A veritable Cambrian explosion. If the strategy in early 2014 would have been to go long of startups, I'd take profits now. Most of them will not make it to a scale up. That's just a statistical fact as well as a prediction. For me, the smart money in 2015 should go up in the scale-up sector. Some of the premier scale-ups are in the peer-to-peer subsector and have been going for a few years. A bit like my fumblings in mid-2014, there's a lot to be said for honing your model out of the glare of publicity. Mark Zuckerberg has said the same about Facebook's origins, that a slow, steady start is often invaluable. The peer-to-peers have done this and now come into a year of ISAs and SIPs et al. The promised land is ahead of them. Riches, success, failures and cock-ups are bound to follow. As for the mature companies, well, a few are nearing that stage, but let's leave that topic for part 3 of this episode. Will they become just another corporate in a tall, shiny building like the existing players? Or will they retain some flavour of alt? My fourth theme for FinTech 2015 is that FinTech subsectors will corral the wagons and indulge in groupthink. I think one of the surprising elements for me in 2014 was meeting so many sensible, intelligent folks who like going to conferences. Now, that's fine in itself. I don't mind the odd conference myself now and again. But some folks seem to go to zillions. I mean, like, literally zillions. I wonder how many a zillion is anyway. One corollary of this speciation slash conferencing is that these subsectors can have a tendency to groupthink. They kind of corral the wagons, develop their own language, peer-to-peer, blockchain, crowdfunding, etc., and inevitably end up with a kind of groupthink, which invariably means certain things are overemphasized, as well as the opposite direction, especially the inevitable elephant on the bed never getting a look in. What do I mean by this metaphor fest? Let's take Bitcoin as an example. What a year. Through the roof, millions of articles, and then before you know it, through the floor. One of the reliable sources I follow on digital currencies estimates that 99.9% of all digital currencies are simply pump and dump schemes. Someone else told me that Satoshi must be behind Bitcoin, as the value is all to do with PR and hype. Brackets. CF modern art, eh? Brackets. One of the sustaining factors here is the sheer amount of megabucks that VCs have poured into the sector, a 9-figure sum last year alone. This in itself tends to keep attention away from the weaknesses. But the elephant in the bed is that what we've seen technically is that Nakamoto's protocol, the engine behind digital currencies, has worked very well, as far as one can tell, at running an accurate distributed ledger with loads of players who you don't know and can't trust. A great leap forwards, an amazing experiment. But neglected in all of this is the weakness of the protocol. Clearly the weakness is the fixed rate of issuance of new coins. Every currency, or currency-like, issuer in history has always attempted to stabilize the currency by varying the issuance rate. Now, of course, in the real world, that hasn't always particularly applied. There have been times when central banks have printed so much money it destabilized the currency. This only reinforces the point that part of a currency creation algorithm is a stabilization function. Without a relatively stable value, it cannot be a sane store of value. So we can easily imagine that if there is a winning digital currency in 10 years' time, which would end up being the most revolutionary sector of fintech possible, it won't be Bitcoin 1.0. It won't simply use Nakamoto's protocol. It would have to be a Nakamoto protocol plus plus. Anyway, that's just an example. I hope over 2015 to drill into whatever topic is on the show of the day and get beyond some of these conventions, blind spots, and sheer let's not mention the elephants. The final trend for 2015, number 5, is that I think the old FS will get sexier and that new FS will get more boring. It's been my contention all along that financial services is an activity. How that is delivered has always been changing. FS was delivered in a very different way 30 years ago when I started my career in the city. Frankly, it was delivered in a more stable fashion which had lasted for a century or so. The delivery process and organisations therein have never stopped changing throughout my career and will keep changing. The oft-repeated mantra about a lack of innovation and change in financial services can surely only be repeated by those born yesterday. Some of the established players are wising up to the implications of the Cambrian explosion. However, so far, the threat to their current P&Ls is minimal and their pockets are very deep. Although we have seen big investment announcements by many banks, which has been repeated so many times, I start to wonder whether in some cases it's part spin, relabeled existing IT budget, or just group PR advertising spend. In practice, the current scale-ups can grow quite a bit and still be bought out before the likes of HSBC or Citigroup et al. Quake in their boots. However, the economics that sustain fintech are undeniable, let alone the challenge of having an innovative company of hundreds of thousands of people worldwide, surely an oxymoron. Equally, the massive regulatory and IT cost burden of being a bank is undeniable. So, net-net, it's a casual bank board that sits on its derriere and does nothing about the fintech revolution. So, old FS will have to get sexier unless it takes the high-risk strategy of doing nothing. On the opposite side, I think it should be relatively obvious that new FS fintechs are going to have to become more solid and, frankly, a little bit more corporate and dull. So this getting more corporate point leads nicely into my third part of this New Year's special. If Christmas is a time for not just family, but hitting Amazon Prime in a big way, it's also a time for reflecting on those less fortunate than ourselves. What connection can fintech and society at large have? Let's not forget that the reason financial services is in such bad odour in the country is the perception that its excessive greed is making excessive money out of the people. Prior to the fintech revolution of 2014, the last bunch of out-of-the-box thinkers and would-be revolutionaries in the city were the Occupy protesters outside St Paul's in 2011. They were pretty dedicated folks, now lost to the mists of time, but sufficiently cross to put up with camping next to some of the loudest cathedral bells in London, which woke them up every hour. Hard to put the finger on the purpose of such a diffuse gathering, however, for sure, the 1% slogan resonated with many. The idea that society has slipped into being structured to benefit most the already wealthiest tiny sector. Occupy started in the US, so let's turn to that direction first. This might all seem abstract, however the UK for one is undoubtedly becoming more like the US. Before we completely fall down that rabbit hole, we might like to pause to consider some of the flip side of America's undoubted successes. Let's look at this flip side from the perspective of an American baby born today. It has a greater chance of being jailed than any baby born elsewhere in the world. An astonishing 1/4 of all prisoners in the world are in the United States. The chances of a white baby going to prison at some point in its lifetime is 6%, a Hispanic baby 17%, and a black baby a staggering 32%. I'll just repeat that. For a black baby born today, its lifetime chance of going to prison is 32%. America kills more of its own citizens than any countries in the world other than China, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. I better not even start on how many foreigners it kills in all the wars and interventions and weekly presidential kill list for drone assassinations without due legal process. Last year, the US Department of Homeland Security bought a staggering, now listen to this one, bought a staggering 1.6 billion bullets. That's the Department of Homeland Security. That's not the foreign armies. 26 million Americans have diabetes and 57 million pre-diabetes. One in three Americans will develop severe depression in their lives, and you wouldn't even want to have mild or moderate depression. Wealth disparity is greater than in medieval England. The racial split of wealth is greater than in South Africa under apartheid. The top four hedge fund managers, and more than every kindergarten teacher combined. In an interesting article by Henry Blodgett, quoting statistics from the Economic Policy Institute, he points out that in the last 30 years, 96% of the growth of the average incomes in this country have gone to the richest 10%. Or put it another way, over my entire 30-year career in the city, 90% of America shed only 4% of the gains in income. And in the past 10 years, the incomes of this 90% have declined. As Obama put it, trickle-down doesn't work. Some very sad statistics. And just for the complete avoidance of doubt, I'm not in the slightest anti-American. All of the above statistics come from articles written by Americans. Naturally, plenty of people over there have spotted the societal problems piling up long before a Brit. Trends in how many Americans have, quote, a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the government show a decline over the past 30 years from 42% down to 7%. The US has some undeniably great strengths, but also right now some undeniably great weaknesses. These are emerging after this 30-year experiment in monetarism, which started with Reagan and Thatcher, and the more recent aggressive foreign policy. It's important to note that this just isn't about the US. One can hardly say that Russia or China are great models to follow either. However, in the current globalised world, most all countries are adopting a microeconomic model of limitless greed. This is not a victimless crime. At FintechHK on Twitter tweeted a fascinating graph from Oxfam recently, which shows an amazingly strong correlation between income inequality and an index of health and social problems in countries. Not unsurprisingly, the countries that did best, barring Japan, were the Nordic ones, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark. The worst was naturally the US, i.e. it had the highest income inequality and the highest social and health problems, followed curiously perhaps by Portugal, with the UK the third worst out of 21. Maybe Europe would be better off without the UK after all. But what has this got to do with fintech, you ask? Good question. As I mentioned, excess spin led to us all reading far too much of the 2014 narrative that London is the fintech capital of the world last year, a narrative which perhaps is driven by the fear slash knowledge that we ain't, at least yet. The other less obvious and perhaps more pernicious slash ubiquitous narrative is a kind of tech envy of the States, understandable given the undoubted excellence and successes of the Valley. Every kid seemingly wants to start a billion-dollar startup. I recall with sadness in Tech Week a couple of young students in the Google box saying the very same. "We want to start a billion-dollar startup." Leading fintechs get asked this question all the time. When are you going to IPO? Who will be the UK's first billion-dollar fintech? Yada, yada, yada. Twitter went into overdrive when the FT reported that TransferWise was allegedly raising funds based on a billion-dollar valuation. So the simple question for fintech is fintech just another get-rich-quick scheme? Personally, I think it would be sad if fintech turns out to be just another way to fill up anodyne, shiny buildings with corporates where the board is paid astronomical figures. Now, I don't wish to criticise this narrative or any fintech who follows it, nor do I wish to spin financial services as anything else other than a way of using other people's money to make money. 'twas ever thus. Rather, I wish to critique the breathlessly uncritical tech narratives about, in effect, slavishly copying the US model lock, stock and barrel. I'm totally with buying the lock. Get the idea about buying half the stock, but let's leave the barrel, perhaps. Tech media narratives are almost de facto about maximising wealth in the hands of a few, and in passing, maximising the hours they work, and thereby maximising unemployment and stress. As I mentioned, the very sad statistics are all from American commentators, the likes of Dan Pink, for example, the well-known business author. Another brilliant analysis of the root cause of the massive US detour of recent decades comes from a US fintech guru. James D'Angelo, the immensely valuable World Bitcoin Network's educational videos on YouTube, has a rare off-piste for him and analyses this problem. He points to a seemingly innocuous change in the Legislative Reorganization Act of 1970. Quote, "Unheard of in any current political discussion, this act of Congress has produced endless avenues for lucrative lobbying of special interest groups." Check it out if you're interested. It is this which has led to such corporatism. That is, the US is moulded not by its voters, but by corporate lobbying. Apart from the military-industrial complex, which is of course a phrase from a former US president and general, we have the obvious case of Pharma. Pharma has two full-time lobbyists for every congressman and senator in Washington. And of course the banks. When presidential candidate Obama threatened to crack down on Wall Street, this was closely followed by him receiving record campaign contributions, more than any other prior president from Wall Street. Closely followed, of course, by not a lot of follow-through. More recently, we had the shocking, well, to me anyway, personal lobbying of Jamie Dimon, head of JPMorgan Chase. To quote Edward Luce from the FT, "When Washington is on the brink, who has the clout to persuade legislators to keep the government open? The obvious answer is the US president. A better one is Jamie Dimon, chief executive of JPMorgan Chase. With last week's vote in doubt, Mr. Dimon helped to arm-twist Congress to pass a bill to keep the federal government running for most of next year. What a splendid public service, I hear you say. In fact, his motive was more specific. The bill included an unrelated item allowing banks to resume derivatives trading from their taxpayer-insured arms. That ban is now history. Who other than a Wall Street titan could demand and receive such a service?" Back more directly to the fintech/tech connection. Newsweek wrote an interesting piece last month called "Tech Bubble? No, it's a Startup Wealth Gap." I quote, "The technology industry has what you might call a Cosby, a dark secret that undercuts its image. Tech on the surface looks bubble hot, valuations can seem crazy. WhatsApp was bought for $22 billion. Uber is worth $41 billion. Alibaba has a market cap of more than $250 billion. But the industry's dynamics have changed in recent years in ways that suggest we're not so much seeing a bubble as a shift in tech's wealth distribution. It's a startup version of the wealth gap. Everything goes to the top 1%. So the Cosby is that below the top tier, you'll find a whole lot of striving and desperation, a burbling stew of stagnant companies, founder angst, and money-losing investments. The winner in a particular marketplace, like Uber in on-demand rides, Airbnb in short-term stays, Facebook in social networks, takes nearly all the economics in that space. Losers get scraps. Tech is definitely red hot if you only look at the winners." A lot of tech vocabulary sounds very egalitarian and nice and all that. In the US, the phrase peer-to-peer lending is becoming less prevalent. Good thing too, as peer-to-peer implies some form of equality. However, there's little equality in a business which is predominantly hedge funds lending rich people's money through platforms to poor people, as by definition the so-called higher credit risk borrowers clearly must be poor. Another ubiquitous phrase is the sharing economy. That's nice, sharing, isn't it? The Nation is the oldest continuously published weekly magazine in the States. An interesting article in there recently was called "Socialize Uber." And I quote, "Cutting through the marketing bullshit of Silicon Valley is a good goal for everyone. But the left in particular should debunk its definition of a sharing economy. Sharing in this case doesn't mean lending someone the use of something for free. It doesn't also match the Silicon Valley description of creating a large number of small-scale entrepreneurs or independent business owners. Instead, what we see is the creation of a low-wage workforce under the ownership of tech companies. At Uber, this arrangement means that drivers have to pay for their own cars, maintenance and gas, while management sets the rates and terms of their labour, taking a hefty cut in the process. A crucial first step for reform is to get these drivers recognised as actual workers with proper rights and proper insurance. Now let's think about what the capitalist managers at Uber are doing for their cut of the company's money. Brackets, 20% brackets, that's my point. They are fighting regulators and hiring lobbyists in order to bring down the incumbent taxi medallion business. They are also spending money on advertising in order to get companies interested in using a ride-sharing service. These are both expensive projects. But of this initial project, what exactly are the capitalists at Uber contributing to the company? Almost all of the capital is already owned by the workers in the form of cars that they pay for and maintain themselves. And these workers labour individually doing the same tasks, so there's no need for a management class to control their daily operations. The capital owners maintain the phone app, but app technology isn't a major cost, and it's getting cheaper and easier by the day. The article ends with a call for true sharing companies, which of course in this case would be something more akin to a workers' cooperative. In an interesting article entitled "The Secret to the Uber Economy is Wealth Inequality," with the catchy label Uber plus Piketty equals 2014, Leo Murani, who hails from Mumbai, so he really knows what income inequality looks like, writes from San Francisco that this model only works well when there's a pool of labour prepared to be driven down to the lowest market level. It did not take technology, he says, to spur the on-demand economy. It took masses of poor people. For me, this work issue is core. There are around 20 million unemployed in Europe, and that's on the official stats, which doubtlessly undercount. Now, a large part of this may be laid at the door of the manned vanity project called the Euro, perhaps. However, more fundamentally, there's a simple and rather unanswered question at the moment. Who creates employment? Up until the oil crisis in the 1970s, basically it was down to companies. They had an unwritten obligation to not lay off their employees, a kind of beneficial paternalism held sway. Of course, this was reinforced on the other side by labour unions. From blue collar through to solicitors, bodies et al., they would ensure that nobody ever overworked. In the 1970s, the hours at a merchant bank were something like 10:30 to 4:30, so few were stressed out in those days. Compare this to the current state of affairs, where every year, one in four of the UK reports their doctor with some mental health problems. Depression is now the most commonly treated condition in the NHS. In the 70s, we also had a stock market convention that accepted that most companies were value companies, and only a few companies were growth companies. Now, of course, all companies have to be growth companies. Banks in particular were thought of to be risky value companies, and their dividend yield was often higher than the deposit rate. I was in a gig on a bank a couple of years ago. It announced profits of $15 billion. $15 billion was clearly an inadequate sum, and so tens of thousands of people had to be sacked. You see what I mean about limitless greed? $15 billion's not enough. In fact, no number will ever be enough. In the 1980s, the theory came that this great monetarist idea that a liberated market would function more efficiently and thereby create employment. Well, that didn't work, did it? So we are where we are. Now the false idol we all worship is efficiency. Companies' personnel departments have become human resources. Homo sapiens is just a resource for the machine. But as only Homo sapiens plays this economic game, then we need a game that benefits Homo sapiens, and the more of them, the better. Let's come back to London. Closer to home, we have more than our fair share of poverty. Synchronicitously, on the day I started writing this episode, Meg Hillier, the MP for Hackney South and Shoreditch, wrote in Tech City News, quote, "As well as representing the tech hub of the UK, an area that some commentators describe as achingly cool, I represent an achingly poor part of London. In Hackney, 47% of children live in poverty. Across the borough, primary schools have set up free breakfast clubs because so many children were turning up hungry in the morning. Head teachers in many secondary schools have put together supplies of clothing because too many children cannot afford to replace school uniforms. I happened to think the other day that I'd never seen a homeless person in Canary Wharf, whereas one does in all other parts of London. Presumably such folks are sanitised from the area." Sad smiley. To end this section on a positive note, Meg Hillier continues, "The businesses of Shoreditch have a strong sense of social justice woven into their DNA. I'm frequently approached by those who are keen to give something back. Many are now helping with code clubs in primary schools, teaching 7-year-olds about coding. Others are involved in the Hackney 100, which involves offering a Hackney teenager 4 hours a week work experience for a year." Another tweet today was from Crowdshed, who hosted one of my podcast recordings this year. "Massive congratulations to @Tony1641. She hit 250% of her fundraising target to help the amazing @missingpeople. So fintechs are creating employment. I've forgotten there's some stat, but money loaned through peer-to-peer to businesses is very effective in creating employment. Crowd-sharing platforms enable folks to create their own businesses and create employment. Brackets rather helps if they have rich buddies or mummies and daddies, but I think we've thrashed that one to death. And as Meg said, there are some great folks in tech who are giving back to those less fortunate than themselves." Okay, so that's it for my 2015 New Year special. I've shared with you some of the behind-the-scenes moments that go into making up the show. I hope also to have shared some useful angles on the creative journey. Without continued creativity, fintech will get boring fast, and keeping corporate cultures creative as companies grow is by no means an easy management task. I shared my five UK fintech 2015 themes: less spin, a shakeout, fintech maturing and breaking up into subsectors, groupthink in the subsectors, and UFS getting more solid, all of which go under the overarching banner of 2015, the year when fintech grows up. And finally, I hope to have stirred some thoughts, or even just controversy, about the broader issue that all narratives have a societal angle. In particular, the ubiquitous billion-dollar unicorn one is predominantly about enriching a tiny few. By its very definition, fintech is helping the people, otherwise the people wouldn't be customers and employees. But what more can it do? We shall see. Meanwhile, personally, I'm looking forward to skiing back down the centre of my podcast piece. We've got some great guests and companies lined up, and I, for one, will be very glad to be chatting to them. It's a far easier task than having to come up with 20 pages of A4 by way of a show. May your 2015 be a great one for you and yours. Happy New Year. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. We are wild like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.